Welcome on to the Dunktown Basketball Podcast. Danny and I are continuing our sort of new series of 15 and 60 instead of 30 and 60, which never actually was 60 anyway. So if you want to hear the first half of the alphabet, go ahead and listen to yesterday's program to get caught up. We're going to start today, without any further ado, with the Miami Heat.
So I think the Miami Heat are one of the teams that's more interesting to me. They're 12-6, 3-2 since the last time we recorded. And I spent a little bit of time just not necessarily trying to figure it out because I've watched a little bit of them, but just trying to kind of articulate what they're doing really well.
Okay, and what did you find?
So right now, they're the best in opponent and effective field goal percentage in the entire league. And what is a little bit concerning, well, more than a little bit concerning, is that what they're holding teams to is 44.8%, which is really good because, remember, effective field goal percentage weights threes more because they're worth more. And that's better than the Warriors did last year. So you have to think that that's going to, you know, they don't have the defensive talent to really expect them to stay miles ahead of the Warriors. And offensively, there are a series of different things to look at. But the one I wanted to start with is that they have the highest field goal percentage in the restricted area of anybody in the league. They're at 66.3%. And of the teams that are really effective there, that make the most of their shots, they're the only one that actually has a lot of attempts there. The other teams are the Clippers, the Spurs, the Wizards, and the Warriors. They're all in the bottom half in terms of restricted area attempts per game. And the Heat are in the top half of that, and they have the best percentage.
Yeah, if you think about who they have on their team, I think a lot of that credit has to go to Hassan Whiteside, who's getting so many tip dunks, alley-oops, offensive rebound putbacks, those sorts of plays. You have Wade as well, a guy who still gets to the basket quite a fair amount. Goran Dragic, another guy who, as a small, gets to the basket and can finish at both a high rate and frequency. So, yeah, that makes sense with the personnel that they have.
It does, yeah. That seems a lot more repeatable than the defense. And then I was spending some time with the data that Synergy now has on NBA.com. I highly recommend it for those of you who like this sort of thing to really be able to see it. And of the players with 30 or more possessions as the roll man on pick and rolls, so that's, you know, that narrows down a little bit, but still a decent number of people.
Yeah, Hassan, and that could be pick and pop, or it could be a pick and roll to the rim.
I believe way. So, yes. Yeah. So Hassan Whiteside and Chris Bosh are number 2 and number 3 right now in that spot of all the players with more than 30 possessions. So that speaks not only to the restricted area thing, but just to how their offense is so effective right now.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say their offense is so effective. I think they're pretty much like mid-pack. But yeah, the ways in which they are effective, and they have two real good pick-and-roll players in Dragic and Wade as well. Bosh is a guy who's a fantastic jump shooter on the pick-and-pop, although, you know, it's surprising to me that he's that high just pretty much on jump shots. He's not rolling to the rim a ton these days. But Whiteside, obviously, another guy. His pick-and-roll chemistry with Wade has been fantastic with those above the rim. But unfortunately, the reason they're kind of only mid-pack despite their prowess in the lane is they just can't hit a three.
Yeah, specifically above the break threes, which is even more notable than the corner. So
yeah, I mean, they can't even take a three, not to mention make a three.
Right, so they're third from the bottom in attempts on above the break threes. They're shooting 11.4 a game. And then, kind of in a way, more importantly, they're also not making them. They're second worst. They're making less than 30%. They're 29.8 right now. So that basically that's kind of taken off the table, both in terms of what they choose to do and in terms of how you have to defend them.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And I don't think really that's something that is particularly going to change a ton. I mean, maybe you could say with certain of their units they could get some better 3-point shooting units. Maybe you could have someone like Tyler Johnson, who's been shooting around 50% from three, to start taking a few more of them, although I am quite sure that his efficiency will go down quite a bit after that. But if he starts taking more, and just due to chance as well, since he's that's a small sample size right now, and you could say Green, Dragic, Bosh at the five, like there's some okay 3-point shooting units, but then you're taking Whiteside and Wade off the floor. Luol Deng, another guy who it's been out with the hamstring. Actually, that's one thing that I wanted to mention. You know, we've sort of harped on the Clippers for having Chris Paul with a groin injury, bringing him back and then having him re-injure it. We harped on the Bulls, same thing with Aaron Brooks. The Heat with Luol Deng had the same thing as well. Deng was kind of nicked up. I can't remember whether he missed a game or not with his hamstring injury, But he did try to play through it, even saying, you know, hey, I can fight through this, blah, blah. Well, guess what? Now he's missed like 2 weeks.
Yeah, and I mean, the silver lining is that, you know, Justice Winslow has played well, but that's still a concern.
Yeah, and, you know, you wonder if they had just let him heal fully. I mean, you should, basically, during the regular season, unless you're just, you know, if we lose this game, we're out of the playoffs type of desperation. If a guy says, I have pain in my hamstring, it just, muscle injuries are not things that you can play through. You're always going to injure it worse, just about. It's just not a smart idea. And when I saw that quote, I became really worried, and you see what the result was.
Yeah.
So we're talking about the Miami Heat. They have had a much better history as of late than they did in their first few years when they actually set the NBA record for most losses to start a year, I believe, since, I can't remember, it was either tied or eclipsed. But one thing that they have not eclipsed in their recent history is their awesome old-school style, as exemplified by the Stance.com Hardwood Classic Socks.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of the Heat color scheme in particular. I'm somebody who likes lighter socks just as a base, but I think they look good with light or dark. And there are a couple teams of that era that I think have nice logos and nice color schemes that we can appreciate.
Oh, yeah. I think I really like the Mavericks ones, actually. That's going back a little bit earlier. Those are striped. They really an earlier Mavericks logo than I was even familiar with. That goes back to like 1980 when they were first incepted. There are a couple of great Knicks socks as well, even like a basketball logo from the Knicks that I think probably even predates their title teams, which are awesome. Two different Bulls socks that are great. I'm a big fan of the Nets ones. We talked about that on a previous. And, of course, the Grizzlies, the original Vancouver Grizzlies for you Canadians who are not ready to succumb to Raptors Canadian tyranny quite yet.
And I love the colors of those Grizzlies teams. And the other ones I want to mention is for those people who, like me, think that the Washington Bullets is a better name than the Wizards, they have Washington Bullet socks.
Yeah, those look really good, too. I mean, it's just sort of a very kind of like 70s style to some of these old ones. I love them. I have a couple pairs of them. Been wearing them around the house, especially as I've been visiting people in the Midwest and it's been cold over these past couple of weeks. You definitely need to have some socks to wear around the house. It's a great way to support your team. And Stance doesn't just, of course, have basketball socks. They have great casual socks, great stuff for skiing and snowboarding as well. And as the official sock provider of the NBA, great stuff to hoop in also. So definitely go and pick yourself up a pair or two of Stance socks. Wear what the pros wear and go to Stance.com. If you're not wearing Stance, you're just wearing socks.
Milwaukee. They're 8-13. This is a team that we were a little bit lower on, I think, than some people at the start of the year. And they're 2-5.
Yeah, I didn't think their defense would be this bad, though.
Oh yeah, I mean, they're one, and there are a couple different. I mean, their defense has been a huge problem. But one of the things I noticed was that the free throw attempt rates their opponents, that's free throw attempts versus field goal attempts, is really high. It's not the highest in the league, but it's 0.326, which is, I think, it's second right now in the league. And that makes it a lot harder, too, because that makes it harder on your offense as well, because you're basically starting all these possessions from half court.
Yeah, and you've got a lot of guys who are in foul trouble. They have a lot of guys on this team who are not the strongest guys. And, you know, you wouldn't think it necessarily. You'd think strong guys would try to use their body more. But, you know, when you're a skinny guy, you can kind of get knocked out of position and then be forced to foul. So that's something that happens a lot for them also. You know, they're not quite forcing turnovers at the same rate as last year. They haven't been executing as well defensively. A couple of notes that I had. One was on Giannis. I was looking at him for a piece that we're going to talk about real soon on the top 10 prospects in the NBA list that he appears on. And he's shooting over 50% of his shots in the restricted area and shooting a very good percentage. The disappointing thing for him, especially since he's played the four so much, is he only has an 11% rebound rate. And if you think of 10% as average, you know, there's 10 players on the court, so it's got to add up to 100%. If he's playing the four, he's got to rebound much better. And they have done a very poor job on the defensive glass. That's another reason that their defense has been so leaky.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And on the offensive side, one of the kind of dynamics with this team is that they've attempted per game the second most shots in the restricted area, which is a very good thing, you know, when you think about this team. And their percentages, you know, they make a decent amount of them. They're not dominant or anything like that. And on the downside of that, with the restricted area, they're in the bottom 10 in terms of the opponents shoot the most against them. And that's never really what you're looking for. So it's kind of, they have the positive on one end, but they don't have it on the other end.
All right, you ready to move on to the Minnesota Timberwolves?
Yeah, let's move on to Minnesota. 8-11, 2-3 since the last time we recorded. And what I pulled with them is something that we've talked about before, but we'll talk about it again, which is that they shoot the most mid-range shots per game. They're tied with the Spurs, actually, for number one. Hooray for that. And they're only shooting 2.6 corner threes a game. That is insane.
Yeah, and if you think about it, and who is really a guy who is going to be in the corner? I mean, just watching them, you don't see anyone there. I mean, maybe Shabazz every once in a while. Tayshaun Prince is mostly taking long twos on his very few attempts. KG, a guy who never really developed three-point range, which was kind of too bad. I think that actually could have helped him be a little bit more effective in this kind of last phase of his career if he'd been willing to shoot from out there. I mean, even, you know, I remember when the Clippers and the Wolves played in Japan in like 2004 for like the first two games of the year. And he shot like a couple of threes back then. It might have even been earlier than that. And I was like, oh, he's going to be shooting threes. And then it just kind of never really developed. He just, you know, settled in shooting 20 footers with Coach Flip Saunders. And, you know, I think that with the philosophy that this team has, it's really just they don't set guys up there. And Seth has done some great work on this, Seth Partnow, showing that the number of spot-up two-pointers taken by your non-bigs is kind of a great proxy for where your offense is putting people. And I think that's the biggest problem, is just the offense is not putting players in the position. It's not that they don't have guys who can actually shoot that shot.
Yeah, and what I think about with that also is Wiggins, you don't really see that happen very often. Sometimes on a broken play it happens, but usually when he's getting the catch, it's above the break.
Yeah, I mean, well, he's too good to be in the corner,
true.
I think, generally. You know, and someone like LaVine, he's not going – hey, I got it the first time that time.
Yeah.
He's not – you know, he's going to usually have the ball in his hands as well. He's not going to necessarily be hanging out in the corner. And, you know, maybe that's something that, like, someone like Bielitsa – be better at, but he's been out injured for a time now, and still, you know, you see him more above the break as well. But yeah, I mean, that shot is such a valuable shot that they need to be taking better advantage of it than they are.
Yeah, and one thing that was I found kind of interesting, so the other stat in terms of their corner threes is that only five teams in the NBA are shooting less than double the amount that they're shooting per game, and they're still making a decent amount. They're 13th. They make 36.7 right now. So, you know, they're not terrible, but they're just not taking very many of them.
Yeah, and for those who don't know, corner threes are generally more efficient shots, partially because they're shorter, but mostly, this again due to Seth's research, because they're more open. It's just kind of harder to get help to the corner, to rotate to the corner. And so when you can actually get open there, or, you know, enough to get a shot off, you're more likely to kind of be wide open, in addition to the fact that it's 22 feet instead of 23.9. So the Spurs were really one of the first teams to realize that both shooting corner threes and taking away corner threes were essential. And the Wolves are kind of the last team now on the other side of that revolution.
Ready to go on to New Orleans?
Indeed. New Orleans 5-15, 2-4 since we last checked in on them. But don't put their problems on Anthony Davis, please.
No, don't. Really don't.
I mean, he has had some slight disappointments this year. You know, he hasn't been as good on post-ups. His offensive rebounding has declined as he's been shooting more threes, and I think just playing so many minutes and just less of an emphasis on that as well under Gentry's system. But, you know, the guy still has a 26 PR. He's the best net rating on the team by far, which is like negative 3.3. Not good, but still better than pretty much anyone else who gets major minutes. You know, the problem is just the rest of the guys haven't been good enough.
And that's really impressive that he's leading them in net rating, considering how under-talented their starting units were to start the season. I mean, you think about that, their depth was an issue too, but they were starting guys like Ish Smith and Nate Robinson. So this is that you would expect them to kind of hemorrhage there more, in some ways for me, early in the season, more than even with the backups, just because teams like they played the Warriors twice at the beginning of the season just are so much better on the front line.
Yeah, that's true. And they're bringing Ryan Anderson off the bench. Some of those early games, he didn't even show up until the second quarter. So, I think if you just kind of go down the line of the guys on this team, either on one end or the other, I mean, Luke Babbitt, a guy who you think of as someone who just shoots exclusively, has like a 7 PER, and, you know, he's horrendous defensively. Dante Cunningham, shooting threes more now. He's shooting 35% of his shots from threes, but, you know, when he was closing against LeBron James in that game that they actually won, you know, they had him in there for defense, but he just doesn't touch the ball for 5, 6, 7 possessions in a row. And then, you know, he might take an open corner three, but his usage rate is like 10%. I mean, you're just not enough of a threat that way. And part of that's the offense too, to where they're not even, you know, having some of these guys get a touch, even if it's just to move the ball, but at least engage their defender to make them do something different other than just decide exactly when they're going to help out in the main action. Alonzo G, another guy who's just not an NBA quality rotation player from an offensive standpoint. And then even guys like Holiday and Gordon haven't been quite as good as they were last year. So it's just, they're just not getting enough support, even with the injuries. Now that Evans is back, those guys are getting shunted off a little bit, but a lot of them are still, unfortunately, in the rotation even now.
Yeah, I think that's a very important way of thinking about this team. And what concerns me also is that they don't have a ton of resources to get a lot better in that. In the short term, they do, because they can upgrade the talent just because they have guys coming back, even though Drew has been disappointing so far.
Yeah, I mean, Pondexter is really the only guy now that they're kind of waiting on. Even Perkins is supposed to come back pretty soon.
Yeah, pretty soon. Yeah, and Pondexter.
But the way Ashik has played, that might actually help them a little bit. Although he was better on Friday against the Cavs.
Well, yeah, and remember that dominant Perkins performance against the Warriors early in the year.
Yeah, that's right. All right. So, anything else that you had on the Pels before you move on to the New York Knickerbockers?
I don't want to. I'm not saying it to be really critical of Davis, but he is slowly moving up the PPP leaderboards on post-ups. He was towards the Alex Len bottom, and now he's up to 0.71. I don't know. I haven't checked the splits. I don't know if you can on what he's doing recently. But when I watch him, he has been better. And also, I wanted to mention that I should have included him in the honorable mentions for the all-aesthetic team. I love watching him. It was just that this year had been a little bit lower, and so he was on my list. He just was – I just didn't include everybody on my list in the honorable mentions.
Yeah, that's true. We did get some rather aggrieved Twitter responses to not including him, and that was probably justified. All right, the Knicks, 10-11, 2-4 in the last couple weeks or so. But you're seeing that – their defense may start to decline a little bit, huh?
Yeah, there are some major, what I call warning signs. So basically, it's like, you know, if a team's doing well and they're still doing this kind of stuff, then you start to sit there. So they're middle of the league right now. They're 16th. But they're bottom five in defensive rebounding. They're bottom five in forcing turnovers. And they're bottom five in opponent free throw attempt rate. So what you look at when you see that is that's kind of the profile of a team that is going to have those opportunities. They still have an unsustainable 3-point allowed percentage. You know, teams are making less than they should.
And yeah, I think they have the best 3-point percentage against in the league. It's like, might even be a little bit under 30%, I think, the last time I looked.
And something that feeds into that, which also might explain part of their defensive rebounding problems, is that they're giving up the second most shots per game less than 5 feet.
Yeah, and considering the conservative style that they play defensively, when you have a guy like Lopez really hanging back, you shouldn't be allowing that many. But part of the reason is because, you know, they're giving up offensive rebounds, and that lets you get plenty of chances within 5 feet. And if you think about it, you know, if there are four components to defense, right, there's shooting percentage allowed, and then the three you mentioned, rebounding, turnovers, and free throw attempt rate. Shooting percentage is probably the flukiest of those, where, you know, it's not really dependent on effort. You know, the other team could just get hot or cold. And so the fact that they're bottom five in kind of the more consistent elements of that is a concern, even though obviously shooting percentage allowed is the largest component of what your defense is going to do. Getting onto the rebounding as well, with Porzingis and Lopez on the floor, they've been totally fine. But with both of them off the floor, they have been horrendous, only corralling 46% of all rebounds. That is basically bottom of the league type of stuff. And with those guys off the floor, their offensive rebounding is pretty much bottom of the league as well.
Yeah, it's definitely a concern. I mean, some of that you think that over, let's say, the next year or two, they should be able to get more depth on the interior. I think that's something that is pretty identifiable issue with them. But when you start to think about, you know, where a team is going this season, there it's not, other than maybe I still love Kyle Quinn, but you know they don't have a ton of guys to really change that reality.
One other thing too, and we're getting to the time of year now where some of the initial narratives, you have to kind of check back in on them every once in a while to make sure they're still happening. Like you remember last year, Matt Barnes couldn't hit a three for the first 3 weeks, and everyone's like, Matt Barnes is a big problem. And then 2 months later, he's shooting 40% from three. But, and we get the idea where whatever happens over the first few weeks, we kind of just think it's continuing without checking on it again. And Porzingis' offensive rebounding is part of that. He was, you know, up near the top of the league in offensive rebounding, around 14%. But now I think the scouting report is starting to get out on him a little bit. And he's down to now 10% for the season. Still solid for a power forward, but by no means elite. So that'll be interesting to see whether, you know, he's able to rebound back to that amazing level that he was at the start of the year, or this is kind of more where he's going to be. I think it is probably the latter.
Yeah, when I was working on the piece that I wrote for Real GM about Porzingis' comparables, that was something, the guy who was actually kind of most interesting to think about with him was Kevin Love. And for most players, you have to make a choice between three-point shooting and offensive rebounding just because you can't really be in two places at once. And the question with Porzingis was always, could he sustain that? Could he be the aberration? Or will he have to kind of, will the team and him and all that have to really kind of go aim a little bit more one direction than the other? And I think what we're seeing is partially scouting report and partially just that kind of duality is very difficult to sustain.
Yeah, and he is actually now up to shooting 35% on threes. And
yeah,
frankly, I'd much rather have him shooting threes than hitting the offensive glass, especially because shooting threes doesn't have that concomitant price that you pay of potentially giving up fast breaks when you don't get the rebound.
So the Oklahoma City Thunder, I think they're getting closer to being back. They're 12-8 now. They were 3-2 since the last time we recorded. And Durant, you know, he missed some time due to that injury, and he's looked great back.
Yeah, he has looked great. I don't know that he has been great in a couple of respects. I mean, one, he's been, you noted that they had the worst turnover rate of any team other than the Sixers, which is 16.8. That is way, way too high, especially when you consider the way they play is a lot of iso ball. One of the big advantages of iso ball is supposed to be that you're not turning it over all the time. And KD has not been able to get nearly the number of assists that he was back when he was. He's still been very efficient in isolations, but he hasn't had as many assists, and he's also had a lot more turnovers. He had 10 turnovers yesterday against the Kings, and a lot of those kind of let them make up a 17-point deficit, and they probably should have lost that game, actually, if DeMarcus Cousins could have made a free throw. So I think athletically he's definitely back for sure. He's had a couple of nasty dunks. Like he dunked with the left all over, I forget who it was, with the Heat on Thursday. And then he had another one where he just destroyed someone over the weekend. So I think he's there athletically. I'm not concerned about that. Ultimately, I think he will get back into rhythm. You know, he's just missed a bunch of time. He's with some new teammates in a new system. And it's just maybe just take a little bit for him to get back into the swing of things from a playmaking perspective.
I agree with that. And one thing that has come back quickly is also that Durant, we talked about this a couple weeks ago, is that he is still the best isolation scorer in the league. He's leading it right now in points per possession among guys with enough. But what surprised me, and since we already talked about them because I looked it up last night, is Blake Griffin second.
Oh, as an isolation scorer?
Yeah.
That might be something to look at. I mean, he's always been pretty good at that, but anyway, the Clippers was yesterday. Anything else on the Thunder?
Well, we talked a lot about Westbrook. I mean, his season, as much as Durant is important to their success, he's having a fabulous season still.
You think they're still pretty much the good money bet to be the third seed in the West?
Yeah.
I can't even think of who would be much competition for them.
Yeah, it's not like the Clippers or the Rockets or any of those teams or the Mavericks are really showing me enough to make anything other than that assumption. The thing that would derail them is health, of course.
Yeah. Let's move on to Orlando. They have been on fire of late, 5-1 in their last six, and frankly should have beat the Clippers. They gave up a late 10-point lead to them over the weekend. Is this a playoff team to you? If you had to predict it right now, will they make it?
God, you know, I mean, I've watched a fair amount of them because I've been so amused with what they've done, and I like a lot of their players. And my instinct is to say no, but at the same time, they've done super well. And, I mean, you think about some of their losses, like the loss that they had against Oklahoma City. They blew a series of games late early in the season. And they're playing good basketball. And I don't see anything from them recently that screams unsustainable. I mean, maybe a little bit just in terms of the way they use guys, because that's super weird. But I think they're... I don't feel comfortable saying, like, oh, they're definitely going to make it, but I'm pretty comfortable now that they'll be in the mix.
All right, well, let's go through some of the teams here. Do you think they have a better chance of making the playoffs than the Celtics?
No. They're not as good.
How about the New York Knicks?
Yes, I'd say they have a better chance than the Knicks.
What about the Wizards, who they currently lead by two games?
I'd say the Wizards. I think the Wizards are better by a meaningful margin, though they've been intensely disappointing this year.
Yeah. I mean, I think we can clearly say they're better than the Bucks, Nets, and Sixers.
Sure.
What about the Pistons?
I like the Pistons better. I think that's where you start to get into the arguments, because while the Pistons have better individual players, the Magic don't have the depth issues that the Pistons have, especially when they're staggering Payton and Oladipo.
Yeah, and you know, maybe you could say the Hornets as well. I'm not going to say that the Magic are better than the Heat or the Bulls or the Pacers, the Hawks, the Raptors. I think those teams are all, especially when you consider preseason expectations, obviously the Cavs as well, well above the Magic. But, you know, I think they could kind of stay into it. I mean, Scott Skiles is kind of using his black magic where he's playing a lot of guys who you wouldn't have thought he really were going to be contributing to this team, but he's getting great minutes out of Andrew Nicholson, his inclusion in the rotation. He's only played 11 games, but 21.2 minutes per game when he does play.
That's insane, really, by the way. Like, that, yeah. a guy's played in half their games, but then, and not like health reasons, you know? It's not like, he missed time. It's just, he just didn't play in half their games.
Yeah, they've gotten something out of Shabazz Napier, as well as a backup point guard, with C.J. Watson only having played 8 games. Jason Smith, another kind of guy you thought of as a fringe rotation guy maybe for this team, who's been excellent. So, you know, Scales has a history of getting a lot out of those type of guys, but you also kind of wonder how sustainable is it when much of your success is based on what these guys have been doing.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, I feel like they're going to end up in the low to mid 30s, which would be a remarkable achievement considering where we kind of thought they were on a talent level.
Yeah, well, I think most people thought, I mean, their over-under was, what, like 34 or something? So, I mean, I think, you know, they've probably got to be a decent bet to beat that. They have gotten so much better defensively. So, I don't know. I think we definitely need to do a podcast in the next couple of weeks digging into kind of how they're doing it, especially if they can keep this up over the remainder of this road trip that they're on.
A team that we hope can do more than keeping it up is the Philadelphia 76ers. They are they have a one now, 1-20, 1-5 in the last 6.
Not that bad, though.
No.
Since Robert Covington came back, their last 12 games, only a negative 6.6 net rating, which is, you know, your average run-of-the-mill 20-25 win team type of level. A couple of notes on them before we get to the big news. Only 20.5% offensive rebounding for this team. And I think when you're playing a lot of the time with two bigs together, Noel and Okafor, guys who at least theoretically should be decent offensive rebounders, you should be able to do better than that. That's basically worse in the league level, 20% offensive rebounds. But Brett Brown comes from the Spurs system. And, you know, part of why I think they've been able to defend as well as they have, despite the lack of talent over these last couple of years or so, is that they haven't hit the offensive glass, but that's still a little bit disappointing. You'd hope maybe they could find a little bit better of a balance there. Rashawn Holmes was out for a while, but he actually, now that he's back, he has a 5.8 net rating in 158 minutes, which is a small sample certainly, but on this team, anything in the green stands out. Mm-hmm. And well over a 15 PR, he can shoot a little bit. So he's another one of these guys, you know, looks good by the eye test too, athletic, power forward. So he could be another kind of one of these small finds, maybe could mature into rotation guys, something to watch there.
Yeah, what I really like about Holmes on this team is that as they're, as we've talked about before, staggering Okafor and Noel can work well for them, as Holmes is a guy who makes that more workable because you have somebody at the power forward spot who can man minutes next to either of them. And also, while Robert Covington has done really well at power forward for reasons that I think make sense, I think I've been kind of thinking that was a possibility for him the last year or two, is that you can kind of slide him in a couple spots, and he's another, you can get shooting from a spot on the floor. So that means that if you have Covington at the four, obviously you're getting that too, but then who's playing the three? And so I really like Holmes in this, and what I hope is that he can eventually slide into maybe a smaller role, but thrive in it, and then be ready to jump up in case, you know, Dario Saric disappoints or however that goes.
So the big news for them, they recently had a press conference within the last hour or so as we record this on Monday evening. Jerry Colangelo, 76 years old, also, you know, well known as an architect many times of the Suns going back to even the late 60s, and also, you know, well known as the CEO of USA Basketball. He has been hired as chairman of basketball operations and special advisor to the managing general partner. What are your thoughts on this, Danny?
I think that it's, I think Rob Mahoney phrased it well, that it's a really great move in terms of optics. I think.
Yeah,
that,
I retweeted that too. Yeah, that was good.
I thought that's a really good point. And for me, I mean, once the news came out that Sam Hinkie is going to be the final decider, I think that kind of crystallized it for me that it is more that side. But that is a good thing for them. I mean, this is a team that has issues in terms of optics, and if his voice carries weight in the room, I think that's a good thing for them. I'm not saying they're making bad decisions. They certainly aren't. I've agreed with pretty much every big move they've made. I quibble with the smaller moves. Seth and I have talked about it before. A couple other people and I have talked about it before. I think I talked about Sanvicini. And I think that having somebody else like that, the one that kind of stuck in my head with it is Jerry West. You know, Jerry West has probably a bigger voice in the Warriors right now than I would think Colangelo will, at least at the start. But it's always nice to have somebody who knows their stuff in the conversation.
I would say he probably, that Colangelo would ultimately have a little bit bigger of a say than Jerry West, just because, I mean, chairman of basketball operations, that's a much higher title.
True.
Than West has. The quote from 76ers owner Josh Harris was that there would be a lot of kind of back and forth, and then Sam would be making the final decision. I don't anticipate that Colangelo is going to be involved in all in the day to day. And, you know, we mentioned optics. Usually that just means, oh, to the press. And when you see a lot of people have been lauding this, you know, some have been had some snarky comments, but overall, you know, a lot of people have been lauding it, and that's good. I think they need a little bit of a change just from a coverage standpoint, but the optics extends as well to just the rest of the league when it comes to trades. It extends to agents. I mean, Jerry Colangelo is a guy who really strikes me as a very, very emotionally intelligent man, someone who has been successful in getting the biggest stars to play for USA Basketball, at least in the Olympics, and his ability to kind of manage egos and deal with kind of the people aspect. I mean, I think he's, you know, someone who in basketball is one of the greatest people ever to do that. So, I think it's a great hire. You know, I'm not at 76. I mean, you can't imagine he's going to be particularly involved in the day to day, but I think there's really no downside whatsoever to this move from Philadelphia, unless he's going to get, you know, really take over and start to, make moves. But with his other responsibilities and his age, I highly doubt that that would occur.
Yeah, I think the point on emotional intelligence is very important here. And I think that Colangelo has really good relationships all around the league. And that is something that helps the Sixers in a lot of different ways. I mean, you have somebody who has, from what I can tell, has pretty few enemies for somebody who's been in the league as long as he has, which is always good when you're in the position of trying to woo talent, because the Sixers are going to have a ton of cap space too. And if you can even have somebody who changes that perception, because something that I can't remember who wrote, I think it was Tom Ziller wrote the piece early in the season, basically that the idea is that once a team gets good, the stink goes off really quickly. But if you can reduce that early, then I think that makes it a lot easier to get the players who will make them relevant again.
And it'll be interesting to see now if this proves any sort of a watershed moment for the organizational philosophy, right? You know, my personal opinion is if zero is just completely not competing at all and playing for the future, and 10 out of 10 is, you know, going crazy to try to compete and be absolutely as good as you can in the upcoming season, you know, they're at a dead zero. I think they could stand to be at, like, you know, a 0.8 or something on that scale, just to provide a little bit better of an ecosystem, both to let their young guys develop as assets and also as potentially parts of the next great Sixers team, and also just to kind of avoid all this crap that they've had to go through. I mean, and I agree with you. I agree with almost all of their moves in isolation, but, you know, I think if they get to the point now where they really start trying to get good right away, I don't think they're ready for that. Josh Harris has indicated that this is not going to be some big departure, but we'll see what happens there.
Yeah, I think Colangelo is somebody who understands the ecosystem of a locker room, and I think it would be more likely that he would be somebody who would be voiced to have, you know, a couple of even nominal veterans who can be positive, kind of be positive influences. And yeah, that might not be the best in terms of asset creation, but it can really help in terms of asset management and realizing the value of the guys you already have.
Yeah, the last thing too is there are some reports that Harris was under a bit of pressure from his minority partners as well, and this could also be a move that will help to mollify them.
Right. Well, minority owners could be a story that we hear a little bit more in the next couple of seasons as well, with some other teams too that have ownership that might be doing things that teams might not like.
The Phoenix Suns, a disastrous stint since we last checked in on them. 1-6. They've had some real rough losses, especially on the road. Although I think they've been competitive in nearly all of their games. And again, you start to kind of wonder now with them at 8-13, if they start to fall out of the playoff race, you look at where they are as a franchise, having acquired Brandon Knight. We see, you know, where this Lakers pick might end up. Knight had been playing really well for a while, so had Bledsoe. Those guys have come back to earth a little bit from a shooting standpoint. And the biggest issue is that Markieff Morris had a DNP CD in that loss on Sunday to the Grizzlies.
Yeah, and that also coincides with Mark Stein of ESPN's report saying that ESPN sources say that the Rockets have an interest in Markieff Morris, but that doesn't mean necessarily that it's been reciprocated. But this is when you start to hear those sorts of things. And we've talked before about the difficulty of trading Markieff Morris, though their power forwards, Teletovich had, I think it was against Memphis, he had a pretty nice game. And
they've been better without him. Like, he's been terrible. He's shooting like 39%. I mean, there's now, you know, you think you got to keep playing him because he's more talented. He's had better seasons in the past, but he's going to keep playing like this. Like, you absolutely need to play, you know, a John Luer or Teletovich or play small or something, because he's been killing the team. I mean, you just got to get him out of there. There's no two ways about it. If you're trying to win right now, even though maybe it's a little short-sighted, both from an asset standpoint and, you know, sort of an ultimate, like, you know, self-realization standpoint of what the best team can be to try to get him going.
Do you want a John Luer stat?
Desperately.
He is the leader in points per possession among guys with enough possessions as the roll man, so meaning pick and pop, pick and roll, you know, as the screener in pick and rolls in the entire NBA right now.
Yeah, that's no doubt going to sustain.
No questions asked. Like, he's gonna make this next contract is gonna be ridiculous.
Yeah, and the Suns, this is a team that really should be better than they are defensively. I mean, they started off pretty well during the season, but they've taken a big step back. You know, and part of that, they gave up .135 to the Warriors in that one game. And really, they are now second from the bottom in opponent field goal percentage, which is not good enough. And part of their problem too, which it would only be fair to mention, is that Tyson Chandler has been out with a hamstring.
Correct. Yeah, I think that what the other part of this for them that I think is really complicated is, would getting the 8 seed, you know, like, what would that mean to them? There have been teams that we've talked about, like, let's say New Orleans last year, where that, I think that
really... It would mean a ton to them. It would mean, I mean, Jeff Hornacek's in the last year of his contract. Sarver is, you know, they've been out of the playoffs for 5 years. I think they really want to make the playoffs as an organization this year. I mean, this is now year 3 for McDonough as well.
That's true. Yeah, there are a lot of structural pressures on various members of this franchise.
I mean, I think the irony is, if they had just sort of stuck to the plan and hadn't had that resurgence in 2014 with that was led by Dragic, where they actually somehow won 48 games, things might actually be easier on everybody right now.
Yeah, there's a really strange parallel to the Raptors in that way. Of that, I mean, obviously the Raptors have done better. You know, they've made the playoffs, yeah. They've done that. But the parallel of unexpected success, changing the plan because it has to, and then just kind of how that change has affected the way that they build assets and everything else moving forward.
All right, let's move on to Portland. 9-12, 3-2 in their last five. You know, this is a team that has kind of, we talked about some of their issues with the second unit offense and what CJ McCollum, the burden that he has had placed on him. But their defense has kind of regressed as well, as you might expect now with, you know, so few veterans on the roster.
And it's regressed, and it has one of the blinking red lights of this season so far in terms of another regression, which is that Portland opponents are shooting 26.2% on corner threes, which is almost impossible.
Yeah, I think the league average is like 36-37%.
Yeah, exactly.
Like that.
So you think about something like that, that, you know, that you're, I mean, maybe they're not giving up as many of them, but you, that number, we've talked before about how you can't really control to a point. You can control attempts, but not success, and that's way too low.
Well, and actually, we've said that, and that's sort of something that's accepted in the analytics community now, that you can control the other team's attempts from three, but not their percentage. And, you know, that's may not be obvious to people, so it might deserve explaining a little bit more.
Sure.
Because you think, oh, well, what if they're just leaving bad shooters open, right? Well, the fact is that over a large period of time, teams have not shown the ability to consistently hold opponents to a lower than expected percentage from three. And so you think if there's no ability to do that consistently over time, then it's really difficult to conclude that when a team is shooting, or opponents are shooting really poorly from three, that it's because they're just leaving the right guy open, because that effect never actually seems to sustain, you know, regardless if whether intuitively you would think, oh, we're going to leave, you know, Rajon Rondo open from three every time. You know, I think, frankly, like, every team is doing that, you know?
Yeah, and you only play a team maximum four times out of every 82, so it's not like every team has a guy that you can do that with. The other point that I want to make with their defense, which is not a red light for regression, but is just a problem that they have, is that they do not force turnovers. They're second from the bottom in the league. The Bulls are the lowest right now, but, of course, they have other reasons that their defense is good. Some of those are sustainable and not. And structurally, there isn't much of a reason to expect that to change.
No, there isn't. I mean, McCollum, Lillard, Myers Leonard, Plumlee, Aminu's not terrible at forcing turnovers. He's got some long arms at least, but, and then even the bench guys, you don't have anyone that you look at as like some huge ball hawk. And combined with the fact that Terry Stotts historically, other than last year, has played a very, very conservative scheme. And I think, with some of the young guys now, he's going back to that even more, to where you just want to kind of stay solid and not give up easy looks when you have a young team like this. You're just going to put very little pressure on the ball. And when combined with the personnel, you know, they drop their bigs back. You're just not going to force any turnovers. And, you know, that's important. I mean, that's every turnover you force is basically, you know, a point off your defensive rating for that game.
Yeah, I think that's a good way of thinking about it. Anything else you want to say on the Blazers, or you want to move on?
No, let's move on to the now 7-15 Sacramento Kings, 2-5 in their last seven. It really doesn't seem like they should have this bad of a record, does it?
It doesn't. And, I mean, some of that is that Cousins missed some time, and they really struggled with that. But they have some constituent pieces. I mean, they played reasonably well against the Thunder yesterday, despite not Cousins continuing to struggle since he got back.
Yeah, they did. He missed three games, one of which was due to suspension after leaving the Charlotte game with a bad back. But he is now 40% from the field from the season. In the four games since he left with that back injury that he has played, 30% from the field, 16% from three, and remember, he was making them early on, and only 8.8 rebounds a game.
Yeah, that's definitely a concern. Do we have time for me to tell a little story about how I was combing through the Willie Cauley-Stein numbers?
Absolutely.
So when the announcement came out that Willie Cauley-Stein was going to miss 4 to 6 weeks with a broken finger, I realized I hadn't gone through, and I was going to look because the Kings have an interesting front court. And I was trying to think of, you know, like how to kind of quantify his impact. And because I have watched the Kings, but I haven't really looked at their numbers. So I started, and the first thing I saw was that I was looking at straight on-off numbers with Cauley-Stein. And they're allowing 107.8 points per 100 possessions with him on the bench. And 4.2 better than that with him on. This was before Saturday's game, so it was right after the announcement that he got hurt. So, you know, the net rating, they're positive with him on and negative with him off. So that was my first thought. And then I went, oh, well, that's probably just because he plays a lot with Cousins. And only 30% of Cauley-Stein's minutes have come with Cousins, so that was another of my misconceptions. Then I kind of went, oh, well, maybe Cauley-Stein's more important. And then I came across...
Look, if we're going to list your misconceptions, we're just going to be here all day.
Yes. But so then the most interesting thing when I came across it was that Cauley-Stein's defensive stats and DeMarcus Cousins' defensive stats were buoyed by the time they spent together. So
yeah, and Kupos, you know, fitting into that, has been one of the real bad net rating players in the league right now.
Right. So the Kings are allowing 94.6 points per possession when both Cousins and Cauley-Stein are on the floor. And with one of them, it's about 106, 107, depending on which guy is out. So, like, basically, those numbers, that 94.6, is pushing the defensive metrics for those two players above, and whereas every other combination just isn't that good.
Yeah, and I think part of the reason for that, if you – now, granted, these are smaller sample size, and we'll get to a few players who, you know, we sort of said, oh, these guys have bad net ratings, we got to watch this, and then it, you know, instantly kind of – righted themselves. You know, you could just have a bad game, or, you know, play against a really bad matchup or whatever. But when Cauley-Stein is in the game, Cousins is the center defensively, right? And he's never someone who's going to get out on shooters or really defend on the perimeter very well. He's a guy who's better dropping back into pick and roll. And Cauley-Stein, what's so good about him is he can actually get out on shooters. That's what he did at Kentucky. He's used to playing that role because that's what he played with Karl Towns as the defensive center, and he was the power forward and did a lot of switching. So when Cousins plays with Kufos, he's the power forward, and I think, you know, they're really getting lit up. I don't know that that's necessarily all Costas' fault. It's just that that's not the greatest combination, and obviously the Kings have gone small as well. But, I mean, with Cousins not playing well, and he also, like, shot incredibly poorly on his free throws for some reason. Like, he was shooting, like, this really weird high arc. Like, as I mentioned, they would have won that OKC game if he had been able to hit a free throw. It's getting pretty close to that time again where you might have to start thinking about that old top 10 protected draft pick that they owe to the Bulls.
I wrote a piece kind of talking about that dynamic for Sporting News. I encourage people to read it. It's actually, and I'm going to probably write more on protection, as people know it's one of my favorite things. One other quick thing on the Kings is that, of course, it's a small sample size issue and all that, but Darren Collison has been the second best pick and roll ball handler in the league in points per possession behind the one and only Stephen Curry.
Yeah, I don't make much of that, frankly. I mean, he missed, you know, basically like the first few games of the season, and you know, has never been amazing as an operator in the pick and roll. So I don't necessarily.
But I think him playing with Cousins, I think that is something that helps him. He is a guy who I think can shoot, and I think we're kind of on the high end, of course, of what he can do. But I think he can unlock some things with them that Rondo can't.
Let's move on to San Antonio, 6-1 in their last seven. Their only loss was to the Bulls in a very close game, 17-4 overall. You remember when they had a bad net rating with Tony Parker and we were really concerned? Well, he's up to 10.1 net rating now, with him in the game, and, you know, is shooting a ridiculous percentage, you know, like 57% or something like that from the field.
Yeah. All that stuff about how their starting lineup might not be their best five. It's kind of, I mean, they have a lot of other good lineups, and I've had trouble.
We'll see. We'll see. I'm not willing to foreclose on the concerns about Parker.
Agreed.
Quite yet. Number one, he looked real good to start last season. Well, I mean, you remember that first game at home that the Warriors lost to them. Parker killed the Warriors. But, you know, by the end of the year, he was kind of broken down. So, and also defensively, I still think there's a concern there. But I think, you know, he's playing as well right now as anyone could possibly have hoped.
Agreed. I'm very intrigued by the idea, not necessarily of sticking with it long term, but I just would love to see a short time where if Manu could play with the starters, so Danny Green defending ones, and Parker playing with some second units, just to see how that would work. It's never gonna. I don't think it's gonna happen, but I'm just intellectually curious on how their arcs would be a little bit different with that right now.
Yeah, that would be interesting to see. LaMarcus Aldridge, not having nearly as good of a year as he's had in any of his past few seasons, still shooting very poorly from mid-range, you know, really around 35% or so. And he hasn't really taken any threes, despite the fact that he did more of that in Portland last year. I was actually hopeful that the Spurs would encourage him to shoot more of those. But nonetheless, he's been fantastic defensively. The whole team has been. So one question I wanted to ask you is, in the last 5 minutes of a close game, Golden State goes to the death lineup with Green at center. How are you countering if you are San Antonio?
I think I'm probably going. I'm trying to figure out the fifth guy. So we'd have one. I'd have one of the bigs in, probably Duncan. We've talked before about the limitations. I hear the arguments for either Kawhi, Danny Green. I'd probably go Manu over Tony Parker just for the versatility and kind
so
of.
So you're going without a point guard at all.
Yeah, I probably would. And then,
but I mean, keep in mind that it's unlikely that they will have ever practiced that.
Yeah, well, I hope if I were the Spurs, I would practice that. I mean, I think that the lineups without Parker is just something they should consider, because I think it's easier to hide Manu than it is Parker, just when you have the versatile defenders they have at the, you know, in Danny Green and Kawhi. But yeah, I also wish that they had it could be Kyle Anderson or whoever, just another guy on the wing, so that playing Kawhi at the four was more palatable. I mean, they have a lot of talent, but they just don't really have that kind of thing, especially if you consider Danny Green, as I do, a guy who's better defending small than defending bigger than him.
I would take out Tim Duncan and go with Aldridge.
That's fair. Certainly.
Despite the fact that Danny crowned him Defensive Player of the Year, and you know, we had that discussion, obviously, I think he has too many limitations, and that's part of why. I mean, I think, like, Tim, he couldn't defend Steve Nash on a pick and roll back in 2010 when they got swept by the Spurs. You know, and Curry is just Nash on steroids. I mean, I think just when they go with Green, if Duncan is going to guard Green or maybe Barnes, expecting him to get out on Curry or even switch onto Curry in emergency, I just don't think that's necessarily going to work. I think that Aldridge actually, you know, he's not that he's going to lock Curry down, but he is a little bit more fleet of foot and has always historically been pretty decent switching out on guys. So I think you would just go with Parker, Manu, Green, Kawhi, and then LaMarcus.
And who knows, maybe Boris Diaw is the Curry stopper that we've been waiting for.
Well, actually, back when they played in 2013, Diaw had some really nice turns where he switched on to Curry. Now
that's what I was referring to, Curry, semi-sarcastically.
Yeah. Yeah, Curry is, you know, three evolutions beyond that. And also, Curry sprained his ankle in, you know, I think it was game three of that series and was never the same. And Bogut sprained his ankle as well. You know, maybe they even would have beaten the Spurs that year, remarkably enough.
That series a lot, actually. That was before you covered them, right?
Yeah. That was back in the dark ages. Yeah. That was before I covered anybody.
Yeah.
But I do think, yeah, I mean, the Spurs, so far above the number three team in the league right now. I mean, it's sort of tier one is the Warriors, tier two is the Spurs, and then you've kind of got everybody else after them.
Totally agree. Toronto Raptors, maybe a team. I don't know if they're a team that's in tier three. They're probably tier four. But they're 12-9. They're 3-3 since the last time we did this, and it's still Kyle Lowry.
Yeah, it is. He is shooting 46% of his shots from three, and he also has a 41% free throw attempt rate. So just an absolute analytics dream. He's at age 29. He's at a career high in both usage, around 26%, and his true shooting percentage is in the high 50s. But those numbers aren't, like, totally out of line from what he did 2 years ago, and he was at 38% on threes. Now he's at 41%. So, you know, I think I expect him to regress a little bit, but I wouldn't say that what he's doing is totally unsustainable, especially, you know, he played this way at the start of last year, too. It's just a question of kind of whether he can keep it up physically. I want to ask you this. DeMar DeRozan, know, he has a player option. I'm sure he will decline it. Would you re-sign him if he wants max money?
No, I wouldn't.
Or what about $20 million a year? Would you re-sign him to $20 million a year? Because I guess his maximum now would be
25.
It would be 25, yeah.
At 20, you start to think about, well, somebody would be desperate and maybe give you an asset. Like, I think at that point, he might pass what I call the Nene test. But I don't think he brings that much to this team that you couldn't replace through other means. It is definitely more complicated now that they paid Terrence Ross the money they paid him, because now they don't kind of have this big pocket of money that it looked like they were going to have. They still have.
Well, plenty. I don't know. I mean, what they paid him, I mean, is his Ross's starting salary is only like $1 million more than like his cap hold would have been. So I don't think that's a huge.
Well, I just think that the kind of the idea of the commitment, and I think you're right. And Jonas Valanciunas is not getting so much more than his cap hold anyway, too.
Right.
But just in terms of usage and in terms of the way that the offense looks with him, I think that he's certainly not a bad player, but I think that you could definitely be open to doing something better. And I think that committing to him particularly early in the process would be a mistake, because, you know, maybe if you're sitting there on, you know, the fifth and other
he could be gone though.
Yeah, I know. But I would try to have an open dialogue and hope that he would give you the benefit of the doubt that, like, hey, if you want to pursue this, we would love to, you know, we'd love to be able to basically match or whatever you get.
Yeah, that's not Masai's style though. I mean, I'm not saying that what you're saying is wrong, but his style, which I think has actually worked pretty well for him, has been to strike early on some of his own free agents that are lower tier and try to get him signed up.
I don't think DeRozan's going to do that, though, personally.
Yeah, no, I could see that, too. But this is my question, though, right? There's nobody else who could create a shot off the dribble on this roster right now if he leaves. You know, on their second unit, I mean, he's basically all they got. I agree. Aesthetically, he's not that great. He's a below-average efficiency, shoots a lot of mid-rangers, although he does get to the line quite a bit to somewhat salvage his efficiency. But I think you could like be stuck in like a Portland situation, or even worse, if Lowry, who already probably has too big of a burden on him now, has to create all of your shots, and there isn't anyone on the free agent market really who's unrestricted that comes to mind who can replace that kind of shot creation, and nobody really even who I think you can look at as an internal development. I mean, maybe you could say Valanciunas, you could go to him more in the post, but you still need someone to, you know, create a shot in the perimeter. So, I think while he's kind of derided, I think that he serves a very necessary function on this team that maybe we kind of underrate to some degree.
I think that's fair. I would also seriously consider, if it were me, I would consider trying to see what the trade market is and hoping that, yeah, it's true that maybe you couldn't get somebody in free agency, but maybe you could find somebody that thinks they can get him, that would be interested in him this year, and then you could try to get somebody who the right fit for either that slot or something else for next year.
Yeah, and obviously a lot of it depends kind of on how they end up this year as well, and whether you want to bring that core back or not. And it's a big difference between paying him $20 million and $25 million a year.
Yeah, true.
And how many years it is, too. One more thing in Toronto that I did want to get to is that Bebe has been showing some signs.
He really has.
As Marv would say.
He looked very solid. Like, the team looked good with him on the floor against the Warriors. That was the game I spent the most time watching the Raptors. But just anecdotally, when I've been watching them the last few weeks, I think that he's been a nice contributor for them. And as somebody who is seemingly high on every non-American big man, it's always nice to see them do well.
Well, he's always had the physical tools. He was compared to Gobert there in the same draft. I always thought it was ridiculous that he went over Gobert.
Yes.
The Hawks basically just totally gave up on him, and he missed a bunch of time with a knee injury early in his career. But actually his kind of breakout game was against the Hawks, a team that really did not have a great way to deal with his athleticism. He can move his feet, block some shots, provides a nice element, finishing alley-oops as well with Valanciunas being out. And, I don't think that a big part of the reason he hasn't played as much is that, you know, he doesn't have the defensive experience and he'll make some errors. You know, I mean, he had a couple of plays where he didn't get out on Steph towards the end of the game that really hurt them. But, you know, with their big man situation the way it is right now, I think the athleticism he can provide, but while also being more of a threat offensively than Biombo, is something that we should look at. And, you know, very small sample, but he has a 26 PR right now, and, you know, maybe someone who could be something.
Yeah, he could be a nice part of a balanced front court rotation. I think that's a nice little role for him. You kind of think about maybe what Festus Ezeli would have been last year had he been healthy. You know, like somebody who's, he's not the starter, but he can give you like 15 good minutes, and if the starter gets in foul trouble, you kick him in a little bit more. I think he'd be nice in that role.
Yeah, I mean, the big thing for him is going to be getting into fantastic shape, which he has not been in so far really in his career. For a guy who's like kind of a string bean, he doesn't have like the muscle tone that you would necessarily hope him to have. So if he could just get a little more explosive, be able to give a consistent effort, you know, because that's what's really is going to make him special, his ability to, you know, have multiple efforts defensively, hit the offensive glass, et cetera, et cetera. But you remember how he came to be a Raptor?
Wait, I lost train of thought. How Nogueira?
How did he get from the Hawks to the Raptors? You remember the trade?
The Hawks were looking to clear a little bit of space, which they used to sign Thabo Sefolosha, right? And that was with John Thomas.
Mostly Sefolosha, but a lot of it wasn't even necessarily used. And I'm not sure whether they could have. I can't recall whether they could have fit in Sefolosha. Anyway, but they basically dumped Lou Williams and Bebe for the non-guaranteed contract, only $1 million guaranteed, of Salmons, and then immediately Wageman. So they basically just dumped those two guys for nothing.
And yet that still might not be the most dubious Hawks trade in the last year.
And then they immediately won 60 games.
Yeah, it's so weird. Like, you've seen that with a couple teams where they've just made the, and then they've made strange trades, but things have worked out, so you don't really hear the rancor on that you do on teams that just aren't successful.
Let's talk about the Jazz.
Let's talk about the Jazz. I mean, and while I'm still in mourning about Rudy, because he's out with a grade 2 sprain of his MCL. It occurred when he was in practice, and from what I've heard, he's out indefinitely. But indefinitely, I think you have a better idea of the timeline.
Yeah, I mean, usually this ends up being, and Jeff Stotts, of course, always has some good stuff on this. I mean, it's really been kind of about 6 to 8 weeks. Maybe a little bit more if it's a big guy sometimes. I mean, you remember Marc Gasol had a similar injury back in 2013-14 that almost sunk the Grizzlies season, but they managed to come back when he returned. And I do also remember that guys who come back from this injury, it kind of takes them a while to get back in the swing of things as well. It's really a shame that that happened for him. Now it's really exposing probably the biggest lack of depth that Utah has, because they already were struggling to find good production as a third big, and now, you know, it's going to be Trevor Booker starting, and they're going to need a third big and a fourth big now when they didn't have either, even with Gobert healthy.
And this will provide an opportunity for a guy that you and I are both high on, who is a starter already, but Derek Favors has been incredible this season.
Yeah, and now he's going to be starting at center alongside Booker. I mean, we'll see if this leads Quinn to kind of do some more small lineups. I mean, we may see, you know, they've been going with the three wings to close games with Hood, Burks, and Hayward. Maybe now we'll see those three guys all on the floor together with a point guard and then Favors as the lone big. So I think they're going to skew more towards an offensive team. But, yeah, I mean, Favors always ranked well in PR, but he's now 26.45, which is right between LeBron James and Paul George.
Not bad.
And he's had some great games of late, 35 and 13 in that classic overtime win against the Pacers over the weekend.
And he had 23 and 10 in a strong game against the Warriors right before Rudy got hurt. I mean, the question I kind of posited to you is, I think he's in the conversation for the most underrated player in the league, though that's hard to quantify. But the other way I thought about saying it is he the least known potential All-Star?
Yeah, maybe that's the case. You know, I mean, there's been a little bit of like Nick Batum, but even he's been around for a while. You know, I saw someone at a piece saying he should be an All-Star in the East. I didn't have a chance to read it yet, and not sure I agree, but, you know, a little too early for All-Star talk. But yeah, I mean, I think especially if Utah can stay afloat here, he's been by far their best player. Well, so what do you think? Do you think Utah can stay afloat here? They're 9-9. They do have a favorable home schedule coming up after they spent, you know, seemingly the entire first month of the season on the road. I mean, I guess they're helped by the fact that I don't see anybody else in this, you know, lower end of the West playoff race, like, running away and hiding.
I think that there, if the goal is the playoffs or that's what we're talking about, I think they'll be fine. I think that, you know, there's always the downside possibility, but we were talking earlier in the season about the possibility they were the fifth best team in the West. And I think that this makes that sort of thing, like, you know, like a better than expected seed a lot tougher. But yeah, they have two consecutive games against the Thunder and then they face the Spurs, but they also have winnable games against the Kings and the Knicks and the Nuggets. And so, you know, I think they could stay above water here, you know, like if they can be at 500, let's say, at the new year, I think that puts them in a pretty good spot.
Yeah, I think it seems to me really staying 500, they'll be just fine. And I think they can be good enough even without Gobert to stay with that. I mean, they're in seventh right now at 9-9. They got the Rockets below them at 10-11. Maybe the Rockets can pass them. But then you've got the Blazers, 9-12, the Wolves, 8-11, the Suns, 8-13. The Nuggets, who are going to drop out further, then you're down to the Kings at 7-15. So yeah, I don't see any of those teams, like, you know, getting a bullet attached to them and rocketing past the Jazz.
Yeah, I agree with you. You want to move on to Washington?
Right. Yeah, last on the list, but not least, John Wall.
Sort of. They lost to the Lakers at home.
Yeah, you were at that game. I mean, we talked about that on yesterday's programming. Did you take anything away from what the Wizards were doing in that game, or was it just a hot shooting game for the Lakers?
It was mostly the Wizards being bad, not the Lakers being good. They had a lot of turnovers in that game, which is a big problem because the Lakers aren't a team that is zealous about forcing them. It's more like if you hand them the ball, they will run with it. And that is what happened. And something I alluded to, I actually probably talked about directly in yesterday's podcast, is that John Wall is a wonderful player. He's doing a lot better recently than he was early in the season. But a bad habit that he's still in is when a play kind of starts, you can think about that there's kind of an ideal outcome of like where the ball should go. And he doesn't always react to the situation on the ground once the action has started. And so sometimes he throws the ball with the expectation that that is still the best move. And the guy who he was expecting to throw it to is just gone. And so then the Lakers guy, like, basically you just gave him, you know, it's kind of like if a defensive back, if you just threw the ball just in his breadbasket, you know, sometimes he's going to mess it up, but most of the time they're going to do something with that. And that's something he'll get better with. I think that's something.
Will he, though? I don't know. He's had really bad turnover rates for his entire career. He's 25 now. Even in these last four, I mean, he said, all right, you know, we're not going to win games with me playing so poorly. And he's responding. He's averaging 28 points and 10 assists over his last four, but he's still throwing the ball over the gym, five turnovers a game. He's had, you know, I think every year of his career he's been like, you know, 18% turnover rate or higher. Maybe this is just what's going to happen with him.
It's certainly possible. I mean, I try to be optimistic on a guy who came into the league young, but you're right. He's been in the league a long time now.
Yeah. So, yeah, you know, they are turning the ball over much more now as a team, 16.4%. But, you know, you did see they had a very encouraging win at the Cavs.
Yes, they did.
When they played without traditional bigs at all for large stretches of that second half.
Gotta love David Blatt just never playing his big men when a team goes small against them. It's kind of amazing to me that teams just aren't doing that constantly just because you know that if it goes badly for a couple minutes, Blatt's just going to pull all their guys.
One thing that is a concern, though, even if they're going to try to go small, is they just don't really have the guys to attack a closeout. You know, Dudley is not really going to do that. Beal is okay. But, you know, if Wall's out of the game if it's Sessions or something handling the ball, I mean, Beal is really the only guy that you can throw it to that you can expect that he can make a play other than just shooting it when it's wide open. So this is a team that you can close out on extremely hard and not really get hurt by it. Another thing, too, is we talked about this at the beginning of the season, and this is kind of another one of those, all right, time to check back in kind of things. Otto Porter had a miserable year last year, was out of the rotation almost the entire year, comes back and plays a lot in that small ball configuration that was worked so well for them with Paul Pierce. You know, shot pretty well, not amazingly, on threes, 37% last postseason. He had a 14% usage rate, still not great. And then he started hitting his threes reasonably well the first couple of games this year. Well, unfortunately, he's now down to 26% on threes. And, you know, I think everyone thought, well, he's turned the corner. He was the number three pick. It was the end of his second year. Played well in the playoffs. All right, we can count on this guy. He's a starter now. And, you know, it wasn't quite enough for me to say for sure that that was going to happen. And in fact, it has not happened. He really, you know, it just has not been good enough offensively to be really a quality starter so far.
Speaking of not being good enough, would it be bad form for me to retweet all the people who snarked on me about Chris Humphreys when he scored 23 in that game a month ago?
Why? Is he playing really badly lately?
Yeah, he scored a total of 9 points in December. And, I mean, he basically has fallen. He hasn't completely fallen out of the rotation. He had a couple double-digit minute games at the end of – at the round Thanksgiving. But, you know, he's just not as good a player as Jared Dudley.
Yeah, no, that's certainly true. All right. Anything else on the Wizard? I think we're about done here. You want to plug something?
Sure. So, as I mentioned before, I wrote a piece on the kind of this interesting nuance with the Sixers-Kings pick that is in the future. We'll actually probably talk more about that just because pick protection is something you and I both love. Also, since it's Monday,
hate pick protection, by the way, but I enjoy talking about
it. Yeah, that's what I meant. It's something we enjoy talking about. We hate pick protection. And I'm allowed to use the we because I know how Nate feels. So it's Monday, so Warriors Weekly came out on Warriors World, and the League Pass Alert, which is the slide list I do for Sporting News, the best League Pass games, either is out now or will be out very soon.
Awesome. All right, if you would like to support the podcast, an iTunes review or rating is always very helpful. Also, following us on Facebook at Nate Duncan NBA and Danny LaRue NBA, respectively, is a great way to keep up with our writings. Twitter, I'm Nate Duncan NBA, and Danny is Danny LaRue. He was an early adopter, so he didn't have to append the NBA to his Twitter handle. And also, if you want to hit up our fine sponsors, either DraftKings or SeatGeek with the cap space code, or today's sponsor, Stance Socks. Thanks so much for listening. We'll talk to you all next time.